So, looks like we're starting to reconnect again. Yeah, there we go. It kicked and finally got it. Okay, we're clear of RFD. And we should be ready to go here. Okay. This program is a BBC 4 documentary. There it is. Hosted by Dominic Sandbrook. It was aired on the 14th of August of 2014. It's called Learning to Listen. And it will be on the archive of the program because I am recording it locally. Please, someone help Matt get with it. And we're going to move. Well, yeah, we're going to. I think we should probably move over to Pound Secret to get so Lynn can have feedback for her show. So if someone can move Matt over to Pound Secret, then we can continue our thing. Clay says he still hears warbliness. I don't know. This is the first time I've done it with AAC, and I'm running it at 44.1, so maybe I should back it down. I don't know. Maybe it's just not a good idea to encode. Okay. Let's try this, see if we can get this program running here. Again, but where'd it go? Dominic Sandbrook, in a BBC documentary, runs 30, about 28 minutes. We'll take us at the bottom of the hour, and then we'll play some more shellac, maybe.
Now on Radio 4, how much thought do you give to how you listen? Dominic Sandbrook explores how the advent of the radio transformed how people interacted with music in Learning to Listen. And we dance all night.
Today, we're surrounded by music. Sometimes we give it our full attention. At others, we relegate it to the background. But before the arrival of the gramophone and the wireless in the early 20th century, listening to music without actually seeing the musicians was a completely new phenomenon. It wasn't until the wireless made music widely available that professional music really started to become part of everyday life. But knowing how to listen and how to interact with this stream of entertainment wasn't something you were born with. It was something you had to learn. I'm going to explore how new ways of listening to music developed in the 1920s and 30s by looking at the diaries of the acclaimed Viennese musician and writer Heinrich Schenker, who for the first decade of broadcasting in Austria religiously made notes about what he listened to on the radio. Schenker's diary is an extraordinary source to track the fascinating journey of the early radio listener. We'll see how his style of listening gradually moved away from the rapt attention of the concert hall audience towards a more relaxed approach suited to the intimate setting of the home.
February 28th, 1925. To our astonishment, the announcer says that they will attempt to broadcast live from the concert hall. The experiment is, beyond all expectations, successful. Never since we've owned the radio have words reached our ears so clearly. The swelling of the audience, the sound of the crowd.
This diary entry dates from the 28th of February 1925, just 4 months after Schenker had bought his first radio receiver, when, by complete coincidence, he tuned in to the first pilot transmission from the Vienna Konzerthaus. In many ways, Heinrich Schenker was very far from being your typical radio listener. From the very beginning, As a musician and a writer on music, he already had a vast knowledge of the classical tradition, as well as a professional interest in what he heard on the radio. Professor William Drabkin from the University of Southampton has studied Schenker's publications, letters and his diaries.
Schenker was the leading theorist of music of the 19th and 20th centuries combined. By the 1890s, he was making a name for himself as a journalist, and in 1903 and later 1906 wrote his two first important books, one on ornamentation and a book on harmony, and that made his name as a music theorist. For him, good music was mostly German and Austrian music. There were a couple of exceptions. He liked the music of Chopin. He loved the music of Chopin, I should say. But most of his heroes were Germans, like Bach, Brahms, Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, of course. But to some extent, there was a negative feel about him because all of his writings had polemical statements. He was not afraid to speak his mind about things that related to music that other people liked and about things that had absolutely nothing to do with music.
Schenker dictated his diaries to his wife Jeanette, whom he affectionately referred to as Lilitian. Ian Bent, founder of the Schenker Documents Online project, an emeritus professor of music at Columbia University.
Schenker's diary was a record of all the transactions that he was involved in, just in case he ever needed to retrieve that information at a later stage. He recorded the encounters he had in the street, the letters that he received, arguments that he had, and so on. Anything that he might need to refer to at some later stage is carefully written down. Whenever he goes to a concert, he will usually give some comments. If he's sitting at home listening to the radio, he'll write what he feels about the performances. His diaries are really a huge coverage of life from high art right down to the mundane.
Although Schenker's deep knowledge of music made him a somewhat exceptional radio listener, his diaries show that his story was actually surprisingly typical of the wider culture of listening in the 1920s.
Hallo, hallo, hier Radio Wien, auf Welle 530.
In October 1924, Austria's first official radio station, Radio Wien, opened. Like the British Broadcasting Company, which had started transmitting 2 years earlier, Radio Wien was a public service broadcaster. From the very beginning, the station broadcast a packed schedule of concerts, radio plays, readings, and educational programs. It was an instant hit.
This was the great revolution. For the first time in mankind, one voice could speak to an entire nation.
Wulf Harant, curator of the international radio archive DocuFunk, based in Vienna.
When Austrian broadcasting started, they had 10 to 11,000 listeners. At the end of the year, they had 94,000, and a year afterwards, it was already 511,000. Oskar Zschäher, the founder and first director general, insisted that everybody could afford the license fee of 2 shilling, which equals about a leaf of bread.
Schenker paid his 2 shillings and joined Radio Wien's audience. The first reference to radio in his diary appears on the 7th of October 1924, after he heard a transmission at the caretaker's apartment in his block of flats. Now, this was just a week after Radio Wien had started broadcasting, and the entry is surprisingly brief.
The 7th of October 1924. I heard a radio program in the caretaker's office.
It took just one broadcast to capture Schenker's interest. Little did he realise that this small box would become such a big part of his life. Even on the day his radio was installed, he wondered whether it was really worth it and whether he would find the time to listen to it.
20th of October, 1924. The radio is to be used cautiously, not only because it has to fit around our work and meal arrangements, but also because its value is still questionable. There are many piano performances, the kind of music that you find in a garden or a restaurant. and it can be enjoyed in comfort at home, but just as you don't sit alone in the garden every day, so rarely is it possible to sit at home.
But Schenker's interest quickly flourished. Straight away, the radio transformed his spare time. And over the coming months, he spent many an evening sitting by his receiver.
7th of February, 1925. On the radio, a comedy by Lope de Vega. Completely bland, but it must have been bland way back when it was first written. Chekhov's A Marriage Proposal was the best. I did not miss the stage at all and was able to spend a pleasant evening at the radio. Lee Leeshen also enjoyed it, especially the Chekhov.
Schenker listened to the radio with Jeanette, each of them using a headset plugged into the receiver. This was pretty common at the time, and if you look at photos from the 1920s, many of which are on the Radio 4 website, you can see just how intently listeners focused on their clunky wooden boxes. The Schenkers clearly listened in a similar way. They gave the sounds that flowed from their headsets their undivided attention. Indeed, Schenker's accounts show that he almost always listened with a keenly critical ear.
April 19, 1925. We listen to the radio from 6 to 6.30. Preuss sings the Schwanengesang. The accompanist, Director Ast, was dreadful. Preuss was very good, only occasionally mistaking the tempo. Atlas too fast, Ihr Bild too slow, and a mere too little movement. In the evening we listened to a few pieces from Don Giovanni before the signal cut out.
Ian Bent, Emeritus Professor of Music at Columbia University.
Whenever he listened to music, Schenker listened in a very particular, a very intense, a very close way. But there's another side to his listening to radio, and that is that he used it as a teaching tool. He recorded the details of all the piano lessons and theory lessons that he gave to his pupils. And from 1924 onwards, you find increasingly that he refers to the performances that he's heard on radio, presumably asks his pupils whether they heard it as well, and then discuss those performances.
The thing that surprised me was that he was so specific.
Hedy Siegel, who lectures in Schenkerian analysis at the Manus College of Music.
He would talk about someone's tone. He would talk about whether he was singing flat, whether he had a full tone, a forced tone. He didn't differentiate at all between the way he listened on the radio and when he attended a performance in person.
Clearly from his comments, the music that he enjoyed most and the performances that he appreciated most were the music of what he called the masters, by which he meant the German and Austrian masters, particularly Bach, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms. At the same time, he listened to much other music as well. He listened to Ravel, he listened to Italian composers, Czech composers, and occasionally appreciated them, but in general, he was critical of them. So although he listens to a wide spectrum of music, the music that he really appreciated and entered into fully was the music of those masters.
These qualities are neatly encapsulated in a diary entry from March 1926, after Schenker had tuned in to a chamber concert featuring the famous Viennese string quartet led by Arnold Rosé.
28th of March, 1926. Rosé quartet. Impertinent. Stiff. With jangled bowing. Like a group of school kids. In short, a gothic horror story. Even though I struggled with Rosé's unpoetic, aloof manner 25 years ago, and with his admirers who had the audacity to rate him more highly than Joachim, I was still shocked and dismayed by this ruin.
At this point, it's clear that Schenker was listening just as he would have done in a concert hall. He listened with complete seriousness, just as if the performer was standing in front of him. But although he didn't distinguish between how he listened to the radio and how he listened in a concert hall, having a radio did change what he listened to. Kirsty Hewlett from the University of Southampton, who has charted the impact that radio had on Schenker's cultural life.
Where Schenker's attitude to the radio most differs from his concert attendance is in his inclination to use it to increase his exposure to unfamiliar repertoire, to seek out music that he actually didn't like. A great example of this is with jazz, which he first heard on the radio in 1926 at the height of its popularity in Europe. Somewhat unsurprisingly, the broadcast didn't go down well.
4th of September, 1926. Late at night, we listened to a jazz band from the Hotel Bristol. Never again.
During the 3 years that Schenker used a headset, listening to the radio became a central part of his life, as well as a professional interest. But it wasn't something that he combined with other activities. Listening to music was still a solitary activity. It wasn't something you did with friends, and certainly not while you had your dinner.
Third of April, 1926. Because we had to break away from the radio for supper, we missed the first scenes of the second act. But of what I heard, I was grateful for the opportunity to hear Parsifal in such comfort. In many ways, the work has been unjustly criticized, although some of these criticisms are well-founded. The allegedly connected sections are put together in a childish manner. The only quality that resembles strict technique is Wagner's exercise in intensifications, which are applied to repetitions that incessantly follow one another.
But technology was changing. By the mid-1920s, people had started ditching their headsets, and radio listening became less of a solitary activity. The first adverts for loudspeakers started to appear in the Radio Wien magazine in the spring of 1926. Powered by electricity, this revolutionary device was capable of filling a room with sound. Listening to the radio became a more sociable activity. You might put it on while you were having dinner, or even when friends came round, particularly if you fancied a dance. Wolf Harrant.
Loudspeakers allowed to assemble the whole family in front of the radio. The effect was, listening to the radio became a habit. It became a part of home life, part of family life.
Schenker upgraded from a headset to a loudspeaker in 1927. But although he'd been freed from the shackles of the headset, he didn't, as you might expect, immediately adopt a more relaxed mode of listening. If anything, he became more absorbed in what he heard, and the radio reports in his diaries tripled in length. Professor William Drabkin.
One example of a more extensive account of a radio broadcast is found in late 1927 when the Schenkers listened to Giacomo Meyerbeer's The Prophet, an opera that was being put on at the Vienna State Opera House. What we find here is that Schenker is not only commenting about the performance, but also about the quality of the music, and even of Meyerbeer's place in music history.
Of November, 1927. The loudspeaker is ceremoniously tuned. The orchestra and voices sound as if we're there, in the opera house. Wagner and Schumann were definitely right to condemn these quadrilles, waltzes and marches, not to mention the overpowering instrumentation and sensationalism. But Meyerbeer should not be denied good ideas in terms of how they are conceived. He surpasses his peers with his ideas. They are apt and beautiful, but are simply crudely worked together. actually, in truth. It's impossible to resist the effect of the music, and one only notices afterwards that they've been taken in too cheaply. That's how securely his technique works.
Kirsty Hewlett.
I do get the sense that diary entries such as the Meyerbeer critique are really a product of the novelty surrounding the loudspeaker after it was installed. Summaries of this magnitude only really appear for around 3 or 4 months. Even by the end of 1928, his style of critique had entirely reverted back to the more concise, pithy reporting that characterised his summaries during the headset period.
12 months after he'd installed his loudspeaker, Schenker's new, shorter diary entries show that he'd even begun switching off programmes that weren't to his taste. Professor Ian Bent.
The impression one gets from the diary is that even if Schenker isn't particularly enjoying a piece of music, he will usually hear a movement through to its end and then turn off. After all, for Schenker, given his particular attitude towards music and his way of listening to music, surely turning off a piece of music halfway through a coherent section of it would render it incoherent, and therefore, in his mind, it would be an act of vandalism.
By 1930, just over 2 years after he'd set up his loudspeaker, the professional tone of Schenker's summaries was fading away. Now only in exceptional cases did he commit his detailed thoughts to paper. For the most part, he fleetingly documented what he heard and when.
October 14, 1931. From Berlin, we listened to Richard Tauber prior to a tour of America. He performs Schumann and Schubert. He is not a concert singer, merely an operetta tenor.
This more casual approach to record keeping went hand in hand with a more casual approach to listening.
In the late 1920s, there are a handful of diary entries where he notes that he was doing other things at the same time as listening to the radio. One example of this is him listening to a broadcast of Parsifal whilst eating dinner. This is the same work that he'd broken off 3 years earlier because of a break for supper. These changes may seem minor by today's standards, but actually, in terms of Schenker's listening, they mark a really significant shift away from how he was listening when he first bought a receiver. And I think that by the late 1920s and early 30s, this is how millions of others were starting to use the radio as a soundtrack to their everyday life.
By now, Schenker was listening to the radio to relax, and this had implications for what he listened to. Hedy Siegel explains.
As Schenker got older, he devoted less time to the radio and certainly scheduled less radio listening. But he perhaps put it on when he was eating, and it would be the kind of music that he would not necessarily devote a great deal of analytic thought to, such as waltzes or dances, even though he had analysed those by Strauss.
You see Schenker really reverting to the music that he likes and listening to much more speech radio than he ever had before. One reason for this could be that it offered him an escape from music as a way of switching off from the work that he was employed with in the day. And he couldn't quite switch off from listening to performances of the masterworks in quite the same way as he could a radio play or a talk.
28th of March 1931. The speaker from Berlin is in Vienna. Very sweet.
That was Schenker's sole remark on a programme called Berlin Vienna. It featured a popular radio announcer from Berlin who was making a guest appearance on Radio Wien. A brief entry like this had become the norm in the early 1930s. It demonstrated how Schenker's attitude towards listening had become more relaxed. Here's William Drabkin.
We rarely get, in the early listening, a dual activity. If Schenker's listening to the radio, he says, I heard this piece performed by this soloist or this group or this orchestra. In the 1930s, he says, I listened to the radio and was playing Patience at the same time, and I won the game of Patience. He's more interested, at least he's more interested in recording, winning a game of patience in so many hands, rather than enjoying a performance of a Beethoven sonata that happened to be accompanying that activity.
With radio now just another way of unwinding in the evening, Heinrich and Jeanette had even begun inviting friends round for special broadcasts, and on one memorable occasion, dancing to the music, something that they would have found completely inconceivable when they'd first installed their loudspeaker.
On the day before Christmas Eve in 1931, for the first time in the Schenker household, Jeanette gets up and dances around the room while Johann Strauss the Elder's Sorgenbrecherwalzer is being played. This is a waltz to banish your cares.
By this point, Schenker had begun to slow down. His health was in severe decline. Although he'd suffered from diabetes for many years, by the mid-1930s, his condition left him exhausted, with reduced mobility and poor eyesight. And as his health got worse, his records of his radio listening became shorter and shorter, now simply recording how he'd spent his time.
8th of February 1932. We listen to beautiful waltzes on the radio at the same time as playing a game of patience in two hands.
The most significant change that takes place over the decade is clearly the things that he has to say about the broadcasts in his diaries. In the first 5, 6, 7 years, he talks about the music, he talks about the performance of the music. In the last few years, he says very little about this. But he probably didn't take radio for granted, because he continues to notate in the diaries when he listens to the programs. If he took it for granted, like eating and sleeping, he wouldn't have actually written it in his diaries.
For me, what's so interesting about this transition in Schenker's listening habits is that this was a really gradual change. It took place over years. And this was the same for lots of people. There was no precedent for listening in this way. It was only when listening to music in the home became a really normal act that people started to think about new ways of listening. And with Schenker, this is particularly striking because you'd never imagine that he would be open to listening with anything other than a very intense focus.
On the 31st of December 1934, his failing health preventing him from leaving the house, Schenker saw in the new year with his wife. They listened to a live broadcast of Die Fledermaus from the State Opera. Of all the hundreds of comments that he wrote in his diary about the music he had heard, what Heinrich Schenker dictated that night to Jeanette, his Lilliputian, was by far the most tender. This time he didn't analyse what he'd heard. He simply sat peacefully and enjoyed it, captivated by the beauty of the performance. Fourteen days later, age 67, he died.
31st of December 1934. Tears enter my eyes. A radiant performance. Between the second and third act, we also drink a glass of champagne with great enthusiasm. The evening was beautiful and dignified in every respect, in form and content. Thank you, Lilliputian. Thank you.
By now, Heinrich Schenker's attitude to the radio had changed completely. Listening while playing cards may not sound like a big deal to us, but to Schenker, for whom music could not have been a more serious business, this was a pretty radical shift. Like tens of millions of people around the world, most of whom knew much less about music than he did, he had now come to see the radio not as a curiosity, but as part of the furniture. He had quite literally learned to listen. And perhaps there's a parallel there with our own lifetimes, because we too have seen the arrival of extraordinary new technology. And though we might scoff at the idea of learning to listen, what might our successors make of the fumbling way that we've come to terms with home computers and the internet?
Learning to Listen was a TBI production. It was written by Kirsty Hewlett and produced by Eleanor Kiff. For further information on the Schenker Documents Online project, head to the Radio 4 website.
Very interesting. And I see that I have dumped somehow again. ZNC has done something. So, an interesting way of looking at listening. And we'll do that later. And it brings some interesting insights into how we treat our modern technology. Dominic Sandbrook, Learning to Listen. I'm going to close it out. Another BBC documentary. This is from 2005. It's called 50 Years Around the Clock.
Now, 50 years ago, the controversial film about teenage delinquency, Blackboard Jungle, was released. On the movie soundtrack was a rock and roll song that would top the charts on both sides of the Atlantic and come to symbolise the launch of a social and musical revolution. As Anthony H. Wilson now discovers, in 50 years, around the clock.
One, two. Every so often there's a piece of music which begins a revolution.
People of today don't understand. There hadn't been anything like it before.
I'd grown up with records by people like Doris Day, Frank Sinatra, Guy Mitchell, of course.
Frank Sinatra, and Bing Crosby, and people like that.
It was all the big ballad singers, the Rosemary Clooneys, the Frankie Lanes, Doris Day.
And they all had orchestras, they all had strings on them. And Rock Around the Clock didn't.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock, ba-dum!
There were no violins on that record.
5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock!
And you had to breathe hard and quick to catch it all.
9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock, we're going to rock. Around 10 o'clock tonight.
What a great song it is.
This was just something else.
It was like the atom bomb had come with no 5-minute warning.
It was an incredibly exciting time. I don't remember anything like it before.
Absolutely life-changing.
The opening scene, the plane in a barn, and someone goes, come listen to this band. It sounds like the Slaughtering Pigs.
I didn't like it. I felt that Rock Around the Clock was a bit corny. It turned me off.
It was the first time that we had a music of our own.
It paved the way for all the others.
I think it was the biggest thing in my life. It just changed everything.
Had Bill Haley not happened, you do wonder where rock and roll would have gone.
Hi, my name is Anthony Wilson, and I have this friend who claims that to really be in the music business, you need to have been born in 1950. You see, if you were born in 1950, you'd be 13 in the school playground when the Beatles happened. You'd have been 18 when LSD and the rock revolution exploded. If you hung on, you could have been a TV journalist like me, and in 1976 put the Pistols and the Clash and the rest of the punks on TV. And then, come your 30s, you could hang out with Joy Division and open a nightclub where the Happy Mondays could interbreed house music with indie rock. What a life. But it's a life that actually begins in 1955. You're 5 years old, just waking up to the world, and you wake up to a strange news story on the front page of your mum and dad's newspaper. Young people, yes, that's young people, are rioting in cinemas and slashing seats. There's something going on, and there's a song which is the soundtrack to these strange events. Later you discover that there's always a song, but this is the first song.
Hold on, wait till I plug in first.
Now, Rock Around the Clock may not have been the first rock and roll song. That is way too contentious a claim to be settled in the mere half hour we have here. But it was the first rock and roll song to reach number one. And as such, it has touched the lives of millions.
I had the record of Rock Around the Clock when I was a young kid. It was on 78.
In this program, what I want to do is to trace the story behind this 2-minute, 8-second phenomenon. How did it happen? Who created it? And how did they come up with that guitar solo?
When I heard the 78 of Rock Around the Clock, I'd wondered how anybody could play a guitar that fast.
Bill Turner was just 4 when Rock Around the Clock came out, but between 1974 and 1976, fresh out of college, he achieved one of his ambitions when he became the lead guitarist of Bill Haley's Comets.
I used to sit up late at night, learn all those leads, slowing the records down to 16 RPM. We had vinyl on turntables, you know, so I'd learn all those solos note for note.
Okay.
Let's take 2 on this. You just scratch that one. I'm not warmed up.
There are certain records that leave a mark upon you, and Rock Around the Clock just burst onto us.
I thought it swung like the Clappers.
So tight, unbelievable.
Fantastic band. I mean, that bass player.
Terrific. Yeah.
It was the rhythm. It was the whole package, I guess. I thought the band, and I still believe, they were one of the best swinging rhythm sections there's ever been.
A really great riff and a mood, you know, that you'd never heard before.
And the opening bars of that would be one of my first recollections of rock and roll.
Sir Paul McCartney, Bill Wyman, Marty Weil, Joe Brown, Georgie Fame and Sir Cliff Richard, all members of the establishment now, but back in 55, they were just the sort of impressionable youths who were ripe to be led astray by this new sound from America. But what is it about the song that is so different? If anything, it sounds quaint and even a bit jaded now. Was it really that special? Well, yes, it was. And it's not just Bill Haley fans like Sir Cliff and rock and roll DJ Jeff Barker who argue that. So does Vinnie Riley out of the Durruti column, hardly your archetypal rock and roll guitarist.
And Rock Around the Clock, it gave us a language. It's like a painter in Africa saying, here is a brand new colour that we didn't even know existed. And once you've been shown that colour and given access to that colour, you can never go back. It opened a door that couldn't be closed.
As soon as I heard it, I thought I wanted to play the guitar. I wanted to do that riff.
Oh, that riff. Bill Haley gave us that kind of riff.
And it was questioned, how did they get that sound? What was that clinking sort of tunka-tunka-chunka thing in the front?
There's a kind of clack to it.
I didn't know it was a guy playing an upright slap bass. I'd never seen one in my life. Bands over here didn't really have them. They played them with a big bow over here in Britain, you know. It just blew me away.
Rock and roll is basically the blues played very quickly. 4 times as fast as it is normally played. So for the mainstream audience that heard Rock Around the Clock, it was the first time they'd heard both the structure and the intervals and the scale and the language, if you like, and the vocabulary of blues music. I can demonstrate quite easily. The tune begins and it's kind of quite innocuous. And then there's a flattened seventh here. Now that's all the first chord.
So which is the note that's the flattened seventh?
That G natural there.
Okay, and that's the blue note, isn't it?
Yeah, except that's kind of okay. That had been done before. What hadn't been done before was that the second note, when it moves to the second chord, it then becomes... And as he sings, we're going to rock, yet another flattened seventh, which is a blues chord.
Okay, yes, yes.
And he goes back to that, which is the first, and then he plays the fifth, but he plays that with a flattened seventh as well. And, which is blues. You know, it's extraordinary.
And what's interesting is the blue note appears on the word rock.
Yeah, that's the door opening right there. The moment the door opens is the moment that Bill Haley shouts, we're going to rock, and as he's singing we're going to rock, that's blues. We're going to rock around the clock.
It's what I always say, it's black meets white, isn't
yeah,
it? It's like that wonderful line about ragtime many years before, which is the right hand's in Europe and the left hand's in Africa, isn't that?
Yeah, yeah. It's revolution, that's it.
Let me do another take on that. I want to get this right. You know, it's different when you're like playing with a whole band up on stage and just like playing it quietly in a room.
Now, with the benefit of a good 50 years of hindsight, it's easy to argue that this was indeed a musical revolution. But how much of it was intentional? It's believed that the song was written back in 1952, and if you check the label, the writers are listed as Max Friedman and Jimmy DeKnight. But Bill Turner here, once he's got that infernal guitar solo down, has a few theories on the song's musical influences.
Along those lines. the song really has a lot of similarities to Hank Williams' Moving On Over. I come in last night at 10:30. Baby, your mind wouldn't let me in,
so move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more, so get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, cause the fat dog's moving in.
Melodically, that's the same as Rock Around the Clock. Now, the original sheet music of Rock Around the Clock, I understand, is vastly different. It sounds almost like a parlor piece.
This version of Rock Around the Clock by the Living Guitars was actually recorded in the 1970s. What makes it so special, though, is that it's one of the very few in existence that is based not on the Bill Haley version, but on the original sheet music.
But Bill put that walking slap bass with the drums and the backbeat. It's not simple at all. Proof of this is that there were so few bands that were able to copy it.
So, let's get this right. Bill Haley's version of the song is quite different from the original as written in 1952, and it's seemingly influenced by Hank Williams. But what about Vinnie Riley's earlier theory that it was a repackaging of the blues? To find out whether there's any substance in that, I turned to former performer and now current academic, C.P. Lee, and I asked him, twaddle or reality?
It's a fraction, a sliver of reality, because we're now re-evaluating blues music. There was no such thing as blues music. If you went to see Muddy Waters in 1950, a third of his set would be blues. The rest would be Broadway show tunes, standards, and the pop songs of the day. Same if you went to see Howlin' Wolf or anybody else like that. The blues is a very modern invention, and we get the formation in the second half of the 20th century as solidification of genres. Now, genres were much more fluid before that. They mixed around and mashed around, which is how they became genres, I suppose.
So which genre was Bill Haley in before?
Bill Haley was cowboy swing. He'd been playing since the 1940s. He came from the kind of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys background, a cracker box hour and all this kind of stuff off the radio.
Well, all right! Yeah!
His father played the mandolin and his mother played the piano, and there was always music in the house. And he grew up not far from Radio Park in Wilmington. And he used to go there and listen to the cowboy acts that would come there and perform. And so when he was 8 years old, his father gave him a guitar and he learned to play.
Jack Haley, Bill's firstborn son and co-author of Sound and Glory, the story of his father's life.
When he was about 15 years old, he used to take his guitar to the Booth Corners Farmers Market, just about a mile up the road from where he lived, and he would play his guitar in front of the merchants to draw the crowds there. And a guy by the name of Cousin Lee, who owned Radio Park, had my father come and play with his band. Then my father ended up leaving and traveling with a medicine show or something, playing his guitar there. And that's how he traveled out to different parts of the country. And he ended up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he joined a group called the Down Homers. He replaced a country and western singer there, or actually a yodeler, who was drafted into the Army. And my father took his place yodeling and actually won the Indiana State Yodeling Championship. And he was called the Silvertone Yodeling Bill Haley.
Then yodel your blues away.
And I didn't realize how good he was until later on in life when somebody reproduced the recordings, early recordings and everything, and I heard him, and he really was good.
Have you ever had the blues in the morning when you're waking with the dawn's early light? Have you ever had the blues in the evening when the sun has gone to bed for the night?
I think Bill Haley was a country musician at heart. I mean, he really loved country music, but he was getting nowhere with it. So he started experimenting with the rhythm and blues.
Whether there was a big master plan or not, I don't know, but I think he had a very keen commercial ear.
Rock and roll DJ Jeff Barker again.
And I'm pretty certain he probably thought, hey, if we take a bit of this and a bit of that, we could have a hit with this.
Crazy man, crazy.
The song Crazy Man Crazy, he wrote because he'd been playing kids' high schools in the very early 50s. Everything was crazy, this crazy jumper, crazy tie, crazy car. And Bill thought, hey, that's a great catchphrase. And he had a very keen ear for what was likely to be a commercial venture.
Oh, man, that music's gone. When I go out and I want a treat, find me a band with a solid beat. Take my chick and we dance about. When they start rocking more, we start shouting, shout, crazy man, crazy.
That was the first hit, because Bill took that into the national charts.
Crazy man, crazy.
But he was still then basically the country band, but giving it a bit more rhythm.
Go, 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 everybody! Go, 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 everybody! Go, 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 everybody! Go, 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 go!
Crazy Man Crazy was recorded in 1953, by which time Bill Haley was ready for that final piece in the jigsaw, the song that would propel him to the very top. Here's the man himself talking to Richard Skinner back in 1974.
Do you remember the first time you ever heard the song?
Yes, I remember it very clearly, Richard. It was written for me especially by a fellow by the name of Max Friedman and Jimmy DeKnight. And they brought me the tune in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I remember the first night they brought it and sang it for me, and I knew it instantly, I knew right away that was my song.
Were you surprised yourself at the way it took off across the world?
Well, yes. Although it didn't happen overnight, Richard. It wasn't a case of just recording it and coming out and being number one.
Indeed, it wasn't. At the time, Haley was signed to Essex Records, and its owner, Dave Miller, would have nothing to do with the song. In fact, to record it, which happened in April 1954, Bill Haley and his Comets had to switch labels over to Decca Records. Here's Jeff Barker again to take up the story.
The actual recording of the song was a complete mistake. Bill's producer, Milt Gabler, had booked the session, and he'd got this song called 13 Women, which he, Milt Gabler, had a bit of a deal going on the publishing for it, which is nothing under the table. And he thought that was going to be a big hit. Let's do this. He'd rewritten it slightly from the original version. There was another version slightly earlier, just a few months earlier, which hadn't done a lot, but Milt had picked up on it. Change the words around, make it a little bit contemporary of the times, brought in references to things like the H-bomb. It's amazing but true.
Last night I was dreaming, dreamed about the H-bomb. Well, the bomber went off and I was caught. I was the only man on the ground. Well, 13 women, only one man around.
All the emphasis, all the studio setup, all the time was on this big song as far as Milt Gabler was concerned, 13 Women.
Well, the 13 women, me the only man around. Well, the 13 women, me the only man around.
They spent a long, long time on that, nailed it. Then they said, well, look, you've got to have a B-side. And Bill says, well, I have this song called Rock Around the Clock. Can we do that? And Gabler said, well, yeah, OK, like, we've got 20 minutes left. OK, we'll do that.
What happened was, the night before, to get it ready, we were in Bill's basement. We rehearsed about 2 or 3 hours, and we had a stone arrangement on it.
Dick Richards there, who was a member of the band at the time. Oddly, although he was present, he didn't play on the recording. They chose instead Bill Gussock, who was the session drummer on Crazy Man Crazy. And joining him this time round were Joey Ambrose on sax, Johnny Grandy on piano, Billy Williamson on steel guitar, Marshall Lytle on bass, and Danny Cedrone on lead guitar.
The secret why that, we knew it. We had that rehearsed, we had it cold.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around 10 o'clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock.
Only one member of that lineup was not at the practice session the night before in Bill Haley's basement. Guitarist Danny Cedrone.
What happened was, they didn't know what to do with it for a solo. Marshall suggested, Danny, why don't you use that one you used in the rocket joint? That was like a pet solo bass. Great solo. And each time you come around the clock, it gets more fun, more exciting, until you're coming down, you're having the best time of your life. Just falls in, it's exciting to play. You internally become involved. And I could feel it with the guys, they were really into it. They wanted Joey to do a solo. But it was in a key that was very difficult. So Joey turned around, you know, which was perfect. It was like a big band coming out with a sock chorus. And man, it just everything just worked beautifully.
They did one take of it, but the rhythm section was just too loud and it drowned Bill's vocal. Time was ticking. And they said, well, we'll do one more. Bill, just recut your vocal, which was pretty amazing for those times. But they did it. They redid Bill's vocal. He got it in one take. Session ended.
I think of Rock Around the Clock, it says, hey, we got a whole new era here. This is your time now, kids. We have our own thing. It's our day.
However, the song's day had in fact not arrived. It would be a full year before it was to achieve the success that we all remember.
The record tanked when it came out. It failed. It only became a hit after the movie.
Because of the movie.
We'd come to Rock Around the Clock via the Blackboard Jungle.
Bruce Mitchell, drummer and musical historian because he's actually lived it, together with academic and writer C.P. Lee. As they recall, once Rock Around the Clock was used at the beginning and the end of this notorious film about teenage delinquents, it shot straight to number one on both sides of the Atlantic. It made an international star of Bill Haley, and it unleashed not just the musical revolution we've been talking about, but a social one as well.
To see it, we had to pretend to be older to get into the cinema, and we put our feet on the seats in front, and we chewed gum and smoked fags and swaggered.
It operated on a level that it gave kids something of their own. When you weigh it up, there's nothing else. Very, very few people had record players, let alone any records. So here was, you could go and see a film, and it was your music.
And they were very, very exciting, frightening as well, just like punk.
It was something that kids could say, yeah, that is ours, it belongs to us, it doesn't belong to our parents. And that is probably the most important thing about Rock Around the Clock in the 1950s.
It was the right piece of music for that film. It was a very controversial film. It was fighting in the classroom and they had a very good villain. It was very dark.
So really, we could throw
in the
away all...
mid-1950s. Evan Hunter.
We could throw away all this cultural and musical theory and refer to it as a triumph of cross-marketing.
It is a triumph of cross-marketing. We've got all the elements in place.
Yeah.
One feeds the other and a revolution is born.
And then, of course, you've got the automatic publicity created by journalists bored, nothing to write about, some kids ripped a couple of seats, mass vandalism. So, in fact, it has all the hallmarks of the classic late 20th century publicity stunt.
How well you've tied those ends up.
Whether it was planned like that or not, and given the way the song almost came about as if by accident, I doubt it was, the end result was still that Bill Haley became stellar.
He stole the limelight from everyone else from about mid-1955 through to the end of 1956.
Chris Gardner, who by day works at the Performing Rights Society, and by night becomes a serious rock and roll fan and an avid Bill Haley fanatic.
If you look at the UK record charts. He was on the charts continuously from around about October 1955 right through to the end of 1956. And at one time in October 56, he had five records in the top 20 simultaneously.
Very soon afterwards, Bill Haley and the Comets arrived in this country, and there's great newsreel footage that I can remember seeing at the time.
I went to the gig, for God's sake.
You went to the gig?
And the balcony moved. I want you to know that. The balcony moved, and they had to consider stopping the show.
We'd never seen anything like it before. Never, ever, has there ever been anything like it.
My father was the promoter that promoted the tour, yes.
Rory Blackwell and Michael Grade. Whereas Rory was the man chosen to greet the Comets on their arrival, it was Michael's father, Leslie, who first brought Bill Haley over to Britain in 1957. This was just months after his film Rock Around the Clock had swept the country and stirred up the nation's youth once again.
He said, I've booked an American act. He said, a band. He said, coming over. He said, I think they're going to be very big. He said, Bill Haley and the Comets.
The Mirror got hold of us, the Daily Mirror. They said to us, look, you're the rock and roll band in England, so we want you to meet him. We want a great atmosphere. The whole thing was to get the country behind it. I don't think the Mirror quite knew what they'd started, you know.
When he docked at Southampton, there were 5,000 people on the quayside waiting for him.
There was absolute chaos there. I mean, the police didn't know where they were. Just nobody knew where they were.
And they took him onto a special train from Southampton station up to Waterloo. And they filled the train with fans.
First and foremost, the train had too many people on it. If you can imagine the tube in London at rush hour when everybody's standing next to each other and you can't move, the train was like that and it weren't supposed to be. But Haley stood for the lot and nobody was too much for him to talk to.
The train was delayed and they arrived at Waterloo in the middle of the rush hour. So you can imagine all these commuters going home from work and the station's full of, again, another 5,000 teenagers waiting for Bill Haley.
You have never, ever seen anything like it. The roads, everything was completely out of control.
The train pulls in. Bill gets out of the train to go to his car and he's just mobbed.
I'd never seen anything like it. I'd seen the hysteria for Johnny Ray, but I'd never seen the hysteria that there was for Bill Haley. And it was the first big rock and roll tour.
They did two shows a night, and on Saturdays they did an extra matinee. All sold out.
My dad wouldn't let me go. He says, it's chaos, he said, you know. It's absolute chaos. You just couldn't keep the kids in the seats, and they were up in the aisles and jumping all over the place. This was just something else. People just couldn't get enough of the music, you know. It was so different.
But by the time the tour was over, Haley's popularity was already on the wane. He may have paved the way for the likes of Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis and The King. But when he returned to the States, they were the ones having the hits, and they were the ones moving the music forwards.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around 10 o'clock tonight.
And there you have it, a song that drew heavily from an old Hank Williams number that was recorded in less time than musicians today spend tuning their instruments, that was performed by an overweight, aging country swing player with a dubious kiss curl, with a guitar solo that was a hand-me-down from days gone by. And yet, this mishmash of the past was the great signpost to the future. The first rock and roll song to get to number one. It was the moment that a music appeared that belonged to the kids and no one else. Who else but kids were going to slash cinema seats? It was the dawn of rock and roll, with that flattened seventh note bringing the blues into the swing of things. And with the tattered cinema seats, this was the dawn of teen revolution. It was, in the end, a piece of soundtrack that pointed the way to the soundtrack of our lives.
The actual energy of the music is extraordinary, and it's just as great today as the first time I heard it.
It introduced me and everyone else in that age group to a whole different form of music that was something that you just couldn't ignore.
Thank goodness that happened. Thank heavens that Bill Haley actually did that for us.
I would have been nothing without Bill Haley. Bill Haley is the king and always will be.
It's one of those things that you never forget.
You listen to it and go, oh, I don't get that from contemporary songs anymore.
50 Years Around the Clock was presented by Anthony H. Wilson, and the producer was Paul Kobrak.
All right, ladies and germs, hope you enjoyed those two, 50 Years of Rock Around the Clock and listening to the radio. I'm going to drop, but I'm going to come back up in about 2 or 3 minutes. I want to get this archive sent off, and then I want to come back up with a non-archive version, so we just play stuff. and have some fun. Or I might do that. I don't care. We'll figure something out. But I am going to drop the stream so I can get the archive sent. Then we'll come back up on the same addresses that we were. So be well, be good. See you in a few minutes. Have fun, ladies and gentlemen. Woo! Good time to grab a beer, have a whiz. Back shortly.